Taiwan Insights podcast. Stay up to date with the latest trends in education and training from the leaders in perinatal nursing education. Here's your host, Sophia Navard.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to A1 Insights. I'm your host, Sophia Navard, and today's show is titled COVID-19 and the Perinatal Space. By now, it's safe to say that many of us have the CDC's general guidelines engraved in our memory, from frequent hand washing to social distancing measures. However, in the perinatal space, there is very little information aimed specifically towards perinatal care providers and pregnant women. We know that this research is forthcoming, but at the present moment, we are joined by two of our very own A1 nurses, Dr. Margie Bridges and Dr. Suzanne Baird, will share their insights in the ways in which they've been tackling this pandemic head-on. Welcome, Dr. Bridges and Dr. Baird. So let's start with Dr. Bridges. Tell us a bit about yourself, your nursing background, and the current ways in which you're working to combat the spread of COVID-19 in the state of Washington.
Well, thank you. So first of all, I just want to say it's a real treat to be able to talk without wearing a mask. I have been a nurse actively working in the perinatal space for over 30 years, and I currently work as a perinatal clinical nurse specialist in the state of Washington. As many of you know, Washington State is the home of several of our nation's COVID firsts, and this started with the very first confirmed outbreak on February 21st of this year, and was also followed by the earliest death on February 29th. On a much more positive note, within a few weeks of the first person in the country to receive the experimental vaccine, that happened in our state. Being first has put us just a few steps ahead of the rest of the country. Local healthcare providers, hospitals, and government officials have really scrambled to transform care to reduce exposure, build capacity, and to protect staff and patients. In an unprecedented, rapidly evolving landscape with what feels like not a moment to waste, we have had to embrace real time challenges and changes and reinvent our traditional approaches to care. So, Sophia, you did mention social distancing measures, and they have been universally recommended, but I think there's been various levels of uptake nationally. In our state, strategies to reduce exposure and containment of the disease was taken very seriously. And this really started a little bit slower with the banning of social gatherings of more than 250 people, which quickly dropped to 50. Schools were closed, followed by the closure of entertainment and recreational facilities, and this included restaurants, bars, and even campgrounds. Closures soon spread to businesses, with only a few exceptions for those that were determined to be critically essential. Subsequently, this was followed by an executive order for all residents in our state to stay home to slow the spread of the predicted exponential rate of increase. And this really actually proved to be quite a successful strategy.
Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Bridges. And how about you, Dr. Baird? Tell us a bit about yourself and the work you're doing related to COVID-19.
Thank you, Sophia, and thank you for inviting me to speak today and the privilege to work with Margie on this. Thank you to A1 at putting this highlight on this virus that is really wreaking havoc in our healthcare system and with our providers and our patients. First, I have been at RN for 35 years. The focus of my career has been on high-risk and critical care obstetrics. I currently work with my company, Clinical Concepts in Obstetrics, where I'm a co-owner and the nursing director. We are a consulting group that works with hospital-based teams to improve outcomes and also to advance the hospital's level of maternal care. With the spread of COVID-19, our company has really tried to think about ways in which we could help our clients and other hospitals that may not have a clinical nurse specialist, or maybe they didn't have an available team member available to scour the literature that changes daily, and then to write some of the care guidelines. So we have done that for not only our hospitals, but for other teams that may be interested in that information.
Thank you, Dr. Baird. All right, let's get started, shall we? So though research has yet to definitively show whether COVID-19 can be passed from a mother to her fetus, can you offer some advice or precautionary measures that can be taken during pregnancy, in addition to the guidelines issued by the CDC?
So to my knowledge, currently the CDC is not recommending specific infection prevention beyond what is recommended for all. Like you said, we've all gotten the memo on the importance of hand washing, social distancing, avoidance of sick people in crowds, and working from home if possible. And, you know, for our pregnant moms, this also includes events like hosting their gender reveal parties and baby showers in person. But that being said, we do know that recommendations and guidelines will continue to evolve as we learn more about this illness, and it's really far too early for researchers to know how the virus will affect the fetus. That being said, although not a new strategy, it is a really great time to recommend ways that mothers can maximize their immunity, and these should sound familiar, you know, exercise, going for a walk, maintaining hydration, rest, decreasing stress. And in addition to these tried and true measures, it is a very opportune time to put in a plug for the influenza vaccine. It really is not too late for our moms to receive this. And this is also in consideration of the fetus. Having the flu can result, as we all know, in a fever, and we also know that fever can pose a serious risk to a developing fetus, especially in the first trimester of pregnancy. So in addition, vaccination also provides a bonus of protection to the unborn fetus and the newborn, as we know immunity is passed to the baby and continues until the baby is 6 months of age when they become eligible to receive the vaccine themselves. So although, you know, the flu vaccine will not provide direct protection against coronavirus, it can reduce the strain on health resources from COVID-19 for everybody.
Thank you.
Also true, Margie, that's so great. I was trying to think of what I could add to that. And I started thinking about moms who were pregnant and wondering, you know, when they might need to seek care, but also to know if they had any pre-existing conditions, because we've heard a lot of information about older adults having higher risk, but really if you have pre-existing conditions, no matter your age, you may be at higher risk of contacting this virus. So here is the list of risk factors, which include chronic medical conditions, and that also includes asthma or heart disease, for example. Another risk factor would be a patient who is immunocompromised, and that may also include a pregnant mom who has cancer, a mom who has HIV positive status, or a patient who's had prolonged use of corticosteroids or other immune weakening medications that she normally takes, a mom who has obesity with a BMI of greater than 40 is appearing to be a little bit more risk of contacting the virus, or a mom who has diabetes, renal failure, or liver disease. So knowing your risk and working with your provider to make sure that you're aware and that they're aware and everybody's on the same page about risk factors. Another thing to do in this time is to know the symptoms of COVID-19 and when to seek medical care. So that would be any pregnant mom who had prolonged fever with cough, to notify their provider, to let them know testing may be indicated in that condition. It certainly, if you have trouble breathing, which we know can be a little bit confusing in pregnancy since about 60% of pregnant moms have shortness of breath, but this would be a shortness of breath that is worsening over time and really having a hard time catching your breath. Or if the mom has persistent pain or pressure in her chest, that would certainly be concerning. Probably one of the last signs might be confusion or inability to arouse a patient, or something a little bit more subtle like inability to hold food or liquids down may be concerning too. And that's when we start to become concerned about how that might drop the hydration status of the mom, and that could lead to fetal compromise as well. So I think those are important things to discuss again with your provider, making sure you know those risk factors as well as signs and symptoms of the virus.
Thank you both. Now let's touch on labor and delivery. What are your thoughts and recommendations for perinatal units on the steps that should be taken during the labor and delivery process?
Well, there are lots of steps, but I think really during these unprecedented times, recommendations of limiting visitors, increased use of PPE, there are undoubtedly the right measures for our safety and based on what we know today. But I do think at the outset, it's really important for us to hold space and acknowledge that these current recommendations are going to dramatically change the look and the feel and the experience that was imagined for many of our patients. There is likely to be many emotions, disappointment, anxiety, frustration, and potentially grieving due to the loss of previous expectations. So all of us are posed with a new challenge of honoring our patient's birth plan. And, you know, that's been a challenge historically as well, right? Helping our patients feel emotionally supportive. We also have to follow guidelines and remain encouraging and provide a positive presence. And honestly, if we can utilize shared decision making, it's more important now than ever when patients come to us with a feeling like they have a lack of control. There is no denying that we are faced with a challenging duality of priorities, keeping our workforce and our patients both physically and emotionally safe.
Thank you.
So important. Thank you, Margie. My recommendations really revolve around planning. As I was thinking about this, I was thinking getting this planning accomplished and hopefully prior to a patient coming in. So the first thing I would highlight would be to have systems and processes already in place, and that would include the team members to call with a COVID-19 positive patient or a patient who is a person under investigation upon admission or even during the triage period. The other thing that I would think about planning would be to know who will be involved in the care delivery. This may include an MFM, an obstetrician, a midwife, an infectious disease person, an OB anesthesiologist, neonatology, pulmonary or critical care. I mean, it just really depends upon the mom's condition. So we want to plan several different scenarios with that team. And hopefully with that planning, we include everybody's role on the team so that everybody knows what their role is in this patient care. The other thing to plan is to know where care will occur. This usually, again, depends upon the mother's condition. Therefore, it's best to have several different environments based upon that specific patient and her symptoms and her stability. Certainly having a negative pressure room is ideal, but at least a private room with a private bathroom is essential if possible. Another thing to plan, and it's already not available, is to put kits together for procedures to prevent having to gather supplies outside of the room and to limit traffic in and out of the room. That would be essential. Another thing to plan is to really use the experienced care providers. Obviously, this is a great learning opportunity, but care of these patients at this time is not the time for a learner, or for multiple providers to be in and out of the room for each patient. And then lastly, simulate all of this care prior to having a positive patient. This will help your team to uncover any systems or process issues and allow time to fix the issues prior to a patient being admitted. So I hope that's helpful. And we'll go over some additional labor and delivery recommendations later in the podcast.
Thank you. All right, now in looking at the news, as of April 3rd, the youngest reported patient thought to have succumbed to COVID-19 was a 7-week-old baby in Connecticut. So with that being said, in addition to the guidelines already in place by the CDC, what additional recommendations would you give to mothers and families outside of the hospital setting?
Well, I do have one. The good news is that the virus has not been detected in breast milk thus far. It's still believed to be transmitted through respiratory droplets. And so knowing the benefits of breastfeeding to immunity and the well-documented short and long-term health benefits, support for continued breastfeeding is really considered an added safety measure that will extend beyond the hospitalization period.
And for me, what I would like to add is really just thinking about the virus and in a pregnant mom. We know that pregnancy does not increase the pregnant woman's risk of getting COVID-19. We also know that when the pregnant woman does get the virus, that they do not progress to severe disease at any different rate than the non-pregnant adult. So that may be comforting to know for some pregnant women. Mm-hmm. With that said, the fear associated with COVID-19 and the threat of the disease is valid. We know pregnant women are fearful at this time. And with that said, there is a role for stress reduction. There's obviously growing in the literature, lots of research is occurring looking at stress during pregnancy, as we've associated high levels of stress with poor health outcomes for mother and the newborn. So anything that the woman can do to decrease her stress load would be very helpful during the pregnancy. Lastly, I think of another consideration, and that's maybe something to keep our mind off the virus, and that is developing a plan for postpartum. Who will be that someone to isolate with the new mother and baby? How will the new mother and newborn cocoon together for that period of time for safety? And what is the plan to keep family members and friends away? I know that sounds very harsh, but at the same time, we want to also still provide emotional and physical support for a new mom, a new postpartum mom, and a newborn. So thinking of ways in which we can do that and still do our social distancing is very important. So those were some of the considerations that I thought about for planning outside of the hospital setting.
Thank you. All right, now moving right along. So being from two different areas of the country, what are some examples of important protocols in place to protect our nurses on the front lines?
I'll start with this one, Margie. First, let me say that all nurses should be able to wear face masks while in the hospital. We are hearing from nurses across the country that are not allowed to wear masks in the hospital because some feel it will scare the patient. We know this virus is passed from person to person, and there are numerous reports now of women who have been admitted for birth, they were asymptomatic, and then they have decompensated often during the postpartum period, and later they've been determined to be positive for COVID-19. In addition, we've also heard of reports of support persons not disclosing symptoms or testing positive previously and not alerting the labor and delivery staff. So as OB nurses and providers, we have such close contact with our patients during labor and birth. It is a very intimate relationship that we develop with each woman to include breathing and relaxation during labor. So it's essential that we protect our nurses and all healthcare providers because we are really irreplaceable to help with this mom laboring and during birth and helping with a newborn. We are such highly specialized workforce. And then lastly, I wanted to highlight some of the things that we were doing in Tennessee and in our state where I live. Tennessee has a very well-organized regionalization perinatal system that has been in place since the mid-1970s. So we have identified level 4 maternal care centers. So one of the key things in this virus is determining the best place for that patient to deliver, and that all hospitals might not have the same systems in place or the abilities to care for a critically ill pregnant mom. All of our level 4 centers in Tennessee are designated tertiary care centers, and they accept all high-risk obstetric patients without verification of ability to pay. So that's really key to being able to get the patient to the right center if needed, if her symptoms progress, but also if she's critically ill. And unfortunately, that's not consistent across the country yet.
Well, that was so helpful, and really, I love what you offered. I would just say, you know, even in the state of Washington, we have a different allocation of resources. We have different configurations of hospitals. Some have more negative pressure rooms than others. And so the CDC offers broad guidelines with some added flexibility based on the location. And like I said, this includes access, resources, and individual situations, which is the reality that we live in. Therefore, the current state of how guidelines are implemented will absolutely have to depend on your individual access to things like PPE. You know, not everybody has N95, so what do you do in that situation? Room configurations. Not every place actually has a newborn nursery. You know, rooming in is sort of what everybody does now. Does that mean, or do you have a NICU? And staffing. So I think one of the big lessons for all of us as we move forward and try to do the right thing is just to remember that not one size does fit all.
Thank you. And before we go, we've prepared two clinical scenarios, and our A1 Insights listeners would like to know what would you do in each situation. So let's start with scenario one. A 35-year-old woman at 38 weeks gestation presents to labor and delivery with shortness of breath and a cough. She tells you that her husband is positive for COVID-19. What are the best next steps?
Well, this is Margie, so I can start. I think the good news is this patient did know the signs, and she did speak up, and she did know that she had had a recent exposure to her husband, and she also developed symptoms while pregnant. It is really important that patients know when to call their healthcare provider so they can receive the best care. So, for example, you know, it might be best if they just have self-quarantine, right? They might not need to be seen. Or do they need testing? Or do they need to be seen in the office, the ED, or an L&D? And what extra precautions in the process are expected? So, for an example, ideally, she would have received instructions and she would be wearing a face mask before she entered our facility. So we don't want a patient with symptoms to show up unannounced, right? But looking at the situation that we've presented and looking at the current best practices and referencing the ACOG and Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine's algorithm, the patient's symptoms of shortness of breath and a cough and the exposure to her husband would definitely elevate her risk. She does meet criteria to be considered a person under investigation. And the current recommendations require placement of a surgical mask and further evaluation. And whether this is in a triage or ED or any location, it needs to be in a place where she can be isolated and assessed for additional clinical, obstetrical, and even social risks. So in this situation, her husband would not be allowed to be present for the hospital evaluation or an admission if it was indicated, but a healthy support person could be designated in his place. So if the patient had no additional risks and she had the ability to follow up with care, there is a high potential that she could safely be discharged home, and that would be with routine obstetric precautions and symptomatic care, including hydration and rest, and then also monitoring for the development of any new or worsening of her symptoms. But I'm going to let Suzanne respond and kind of tackle what would be the next best steps if it was determined that she did need further treatment and she did need an admission.
Thank you, Margie. Well, I know if it were me, I would probably take a big, deep breath at that point and acknowledge my fear. But I would also want to not let that fear overtake me and not to really personalize my care based upon this woman's needs. And to not forget her needs as a laboring mom if she were in labor. So with that said, what are some of the things that I think that could be helpful to think about? The first thing is increasing our surveillance of this mom. We know that these women are going to be high risk, and they're going to need increased surveillance, and our assessments are so key and so important. But specifically, what should we be assessing as far as disease-specific assessment parameters? One that I think of that we need to really highlight is our breath sounds. We would certainly do those on admission, but then possibly every 2 hours taking a listen to her lungs. And again, personalizing this based upon the patient's symptoms. Looking for signs of shortness of breath and increasing work of breathing. Does she have dyspnea? Does she have a cough? And if she has a cough, is it productive or non-productive? Does she have a sore throat? Does she have persistent pain or pressure in her chest? And we don't, with that, want to assume that a patient with a respiratory compromise has anxiety. She certainly could have anxiety, but we want to make sure that her anxiety is not related to a lack of oxygen. What is her skin color and temperature? And does she have any gastrointestinal symptoms? Those would be our disease-specific assessment parameters. Then we would want to obviously frequently evaluate the woman's oxygenation. You know, pregnant moms and the physiologic changes in pregnancy allow them to the ability to compensate with deterioration in respiratory function for a period of time but then they'll have sudden decompensation. Therefore, it's really essential to recognize signs and symptoms of respiratory decompensation, such as a rising respiratory rate. So we see that respiratory rate go up. It's 20, it's 22, 24, 26, 28. That's just too high. Does she have increased shortness of breath and anxiety? Is she sitting up in the bed? Is she using her accessory muscles to breathe? If this woman had progressing signs of respiratory decompensation, we would then want the nurse to notify the provider and then have the provider come to the bedside for a timely assessment, diagnosis, and intervention. Hmm. Another thing that we want to think about is determining if the woman has risk factors for disease progression. And we previously discussed that earlier, if she had any of the risk factors such as asthma. Another thing that we would want the nurse to do is to anticipate orders and needed procedures. Certainly, she's going to need an IV. She's going to need lots of lab work and probably a chest x-ray to rule out pneumonia. So those we would want to anticipate. And we would want to limit any kind of providers in and out of the room, but also movement within the hospital. As far as labor or induction of labor for this scenario, I would not expect the woman in this scenario to be induced at this time. And the reason for that is that the massive amount of oxygen utilization that occurs during labor. And if this woman is compromised, that can further her compromise. And we know that C-section is not indicated except for obstetric reasons. If the woman, let's say she goes into labor, what would be some of the care provisions that we would need to think about? First, she would need to have continuous fetal monitoring if she's a viable gestation because she's a high-risk patient. Have anesthesiology consult with this patient and really consider having an early epidural placed. The reason for that is that we want to avoid OB emergencies if at all possible, and we definitely want to also avoid general anesthesia if possible. Mm-hmm. So also thinking about avoiding OB emergencies, watch your Pitocin management, manage any blood pressure changes swiftly and effectively, and avoid fetal compromise. The other things that we think about in labor and are recommending is that nitrous oxide is a potential, the use of that for pain management gives a potential for aerosolization of the virus. So a lot of units are not using that at this time. And in addition, same thing goes for oxygen. Face mask oxygen has been one of the premier and long time uses for intrauterine fetal resuscitation. But again, due to the risk of aerosol transmission, it is recommended that we do not use face mask oxygen at this time for that purpose. I do know some hospitals are using oxygen for category 2 fetal strips, but only with nasal cannula. Certainly, if you have a category 3 strip, then you're moving more towards delivery or making sure that we can fix that tracing, and that's when that nasal cannula oxygen may be used as well. But really check with your hospital recommendations. I know ACOG is really not recommending using it at this time, but we want to make sure that we're practicing and keeping up with those practice changes. And then just a few more things about in labor, if the mom is in labor. Right now, using positioning aids are being discouraged due to the risk of contamination and the spread of virus, and those are like our peanut balls. Certainly, I know some nurses that are getting creative and using pillows and stirrups and those types of things. And then lastly, have a plan for the neonate and in that second stage of labor. The second stage of labor, we want to make sure that everybody has PPE and really treating this patient as if she was positive. And then anticipating that this mom might be so exhausted that she's not able to push. So we may anticipate as nurses the need for laboring down or an operative vaginal birth. Also not recommended to delay cord clamping, and also we need to make sure that we're prepared for the potential of postpartum hemorrhage.
Thank you. All right, so now for scenario 2. A 30-year-old woman at 39 weeks gestation is scheduled for a cesarean delivery. She tested positive for COVID-19 last week. What are the recommended best next steps?
Margie, I'll start with this one. First, I guess I would have some questions with this scenario. First thing I would ask is, why are we going ahead and doing a C-section on a positive mom? She's 39 weeks and not post-date. The second question I would ask is, what is the indication for the C-section? Is she a repeat? Does she have another medical condition, like diabetes? So I would ask these questions because there are no data right now that supports scheduled cesarean birth due to maternal infection with COVID-19. Cesarean birth is only recommended with these patients for obstetric indications. So, and when you think about a C-section, it really places the woman's risk at a higher level when we do a C-section on a mom. The other question I would ask is, if this patient was a previous C-section, would she be a candidate for a trial of labor and possible VBAC that may reduce her risk? And then my last question would be, why not wait until she heals and has a negative test? That might be safer for the mom. So those would be my questions. If the plan was to go ahead and progress with a C-section, here are some of my general recommendations and that's based upon the literature. All patients for scheduled C-section should have a pre-hospital screening by anesthesiology, if at all possible. Now, I know if the mom is transported into your system, that wouldn't be possible. But if this patient in this scenario had a planned scheduled section, then having pre-screening would be essential, and it's also recommended. We would certainly want to implement contact, droplet, and airborne precautions in the OR, and that would be according to your hospital best practices. We would want to allow adequate time between operative cases for a thorough cleaning of the room and for air exchange. And again, we're going to need to work with another department, such as our environmental team, to determine what that time is. And then we would want to notify anesthesiology on admission early and get them involved in the care. And we would anticipate neural axial anesthesia. If for some reason general anesthesia is required, for example, in some of our patients that we're seeing come in, they have low platelets. And so they may require general anesthesia, or that may be determined the safest. We would want to then plan for extubation for that patient, or if we anticipated a need for continued ventilation following the C-section, where would that care be provided in the hospital, and then plan out that care for the patient. And then during the C-section, double gloving is recommended for persons who are scrubbed in on the case. I'll let Margie take it from that part.
Okay. Well, that was so helpful, really, to think about things that we should, contemplate questions we should ask, and then I love the steps that you provided. So I'm going to get us to the fact that this baby is born, and to protect the infant that is not infected with COVID-19 from being infected by a mother who is under investigation or positive, as Suzanne said, delayed cord clamping would not be recommended, and also the first bath would not be delayed. For the infant that was born in this scenario, the CDC is recommending isolation from the mother, but it also advises that healthcare providers discuss the risks and make the decision regarding the location of the infant with the mother. So if we have determined and everybody agrees that the infant should be isolated and a mother still would like to breastfeed, she is encouraged to pump breast milk with proper hand hygiene, hand washing, and wearing a mask so that the infant can be fed breast milk by a healthy caregiver. According to the AAP, infant testing for COVID-19 for this baby is recommended around 24 hours with repeat testing at 48 hours unless the newborn has been discharged home. Now, decisions around discharge should be based on the individual infant meeting normal criteria and expected milestones. If the infant could not be tested or if If the infant could not be tested, he or she is considered positive for a 14-day observation period. But if asymptomatic, the plan could be to include discharging to home with a need for frequent outpatient follow-up through 14 days of age. And this can happen either by phone, telemedicine, or in the office. So in general, I think we do know that early discharge for babies and moms is a recommended best practice.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bridges and Dr. Baird. As we come to a close, do you have any parting words that you'd like to include for our nurses and parents-to-be as we continue to navigate through this pandemic together?
Well, this is Suzanne. I really want to thank all of the bedside nurses. You are my hero. In addition to the leaders who are then supporting those bedside nurses, such an important task, and I really appreciate your efforts. I know there is a lot of fear. And one thing that we have emphasized in this podcast is being prepared. We want to seek to understand, and we can't just focus on COVID-19 care and forget about the other important aspects of care. So I think this is an opportune moment to really lean towards supporting physiologic and the emotional needs of the patient. Being prepared with a plan of how care will be provided for these patients may decrease some of our fear, not only for the staff, but for the woman and her support person. Bless all of you as you continue to provide such high quality, high touch, specialized care. Thank you so much.
Well, and thank you. I really do believe there's no doubt that your insight has really helped us all to be prepared and to decrease our fear. So I loved what you shared today. Sophia, I also think you really nailed it when you said that we're all in this together. We really are. We're in it together. We're not alone. And staying connected is essential. Community is important. So nurses, healthcare providers, and expected parents should be encouraged to reach out, share their stories, and support to each other during this very, very challenging time. So thank you all. Again, I'm forever grateful for all that you have done and will continue to do.
Thank you both. And we'd like to send a special thank you to the nurses, nursing assistants, physicians, housekeepers, first responders, and all those who are currently putting their lives on the line in the fight against COVID-19. Words can't begin to express our gratitude. God bless you and your families. And Dr. Bridges, Dr. Baird, again, thank you for all that you do. And most importantly, thank you for stepping away from your work and taking the time to share your insights with us today. And to all of our listeners, please note that this information is not intended to replace the guidelines that have been set by the CDC or a consultation with your provider. For more information, you may also visit our website at a1.org and click on the red COVID-19 banner. As always, if you're having an emergency, please dial 911. Until we meet again, this has been Sophia Navard for A1 Insights.